Great. Well, if you do have a Bible, you might want to turn to Genesis chapter 39. If you don't worry, the words will come up on the screen. And I want to kick this series off tonight by looking at a passage that I really felt personally God has been drawing me to over the last few months. He's been speaking to me personally about this. But I also feel like there's something prophetic for us as a church in this passage. And Genesis 39 details part of the story of the life of Joseph. Just wave at me if you've ever read the story of Joseph. Okay. Joseph has an incredible story. I encourage you to read it. You can pick up the story from Genesis 37 onwards, which is the first book in your Bible. And Joseph, just for those of you that maybe are not familiar with him, I'll kind of catch you up with the story before we dive into Genesis 39. Joseph was one of 12 sons to his father, Jacob. Jacob is one of the great kind of fathers or patriarchs in Israel's history. He had Abraham, he had son Isaac. Isaac had a son Esau and Jacob. And then Jacob in turn has 12 sons. And Joseph was the second youngest son of his father Jacob. And he lived an amazing life. His story is an astonishing story because we find that by the age of just 30 years old, Joseph has risen to a place where he is one of the most influential, powerful, international statesmen in the world at the time. And he is working in probably the superpower nation of the time, which was Egypt. And in just a short period of time, we find that Joseph rises to this place where he has incredible kingdom authority. And in fact, so much so, there was such favor upon his life that he was given wisdom to know literally how to feed millions of people in a time of severe famine in Egypt and right across that area of the world at the time. He was a man who did literally live a life beyond himself. He knew what it was like not just to live for himself, but to live a life that literally blessed multitudes of people. And guess what? That is exactly what God has called you and I to. That is exactly what he's called us to as a church community, to be a church that gets outside of our own box and actually blesses the multitudes, even the nations of the earth. That's God's plan for this community, just like it was for Joseph. And we find Joseph being introduced to us earlier on in Genesis 37, where we find that he is a 17-year-old shepherd boy when we first hear about him. He's looking after his father's sheep. And he is his father's favorite. He's his father's favorite. In fact, not just his favorite, but his father Jacob begins to show incredible favoritism towards Joseph. Now, how many of you know that there's a difference between favor and favoritism? Big difference. And in Jacob's family, he so favored Joseph that he even gave him a present, a gift of a multicolored coat. I don't know, any of you seen Joseph the Musical? You can start humming or singing or whistling at this point if you want to in the background. And he was given this amazing technicolor coat by his father Jacob as a sign that you are my favorite sons. I like all the other guys, but you are my favorites. Now, just a pause here for you fathers here. This is not a good move. This is not a good move to set someone up in your family as your favorite and to show them favoritism. The truth is God, though he favors us, he does not show favoritism. The truth is you are all God's favorites. You are all God's favorites. And actually in the same way that Jacob clothed Joseph in a royal robe, God has clothed you now in royal robes of righteousness. You are each his special treasure. And then around this time in Joseph's life, he begins to dream some incredible prophetic dreams about the future in his life. And he has a recurring dream. And the dream he starts to have is that one day he will become a mighty, powerful ruler, which was true. And he also dreams that his brothers, his older brothers, and indeed his father, will bow down to him as a powerful ruler. And he begins to share this dream, this revelation with his family, which, as you can imagine, went down like a lead balloon. And the result of this revelation is that his brothers begin to hate Joseph with a fierce hatred. And they began to plot in their hearts how they can do him harm because they hate this little upstart with these prophetic revelations. How many of you know that you can share the right message in the wrong way and it can cause disaster? Well, that's exactly what began to happen around Joseph. As a young 17-year-old who didn't really know how to handle his gifts, he starts to cause this maelstrom of hatred and aggression around him. And eventually in the story, we find that his brothers plot to kill him. They strip him of his multicolored garment. They throw him down a hole. And eventually they sell him, their own brother, into slavery into Egypt. And Joseph faces the worst kind of rejection possible. And so as we pick up the story in Genesis 39, all of these events have just happened to Joseph. He is a long way from home. He is away from his family. He's been rejected by his brothers. And he is coping with a brand new season in his life. And so we'll read together and pick up the story in Genesis chapter 39. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials and the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything that he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything that Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So he left everything in Joseph's care, everything he had, with Joseph in charge. He did not concern himself with anything except the food he ate. That sounds nice, doesn't it? Now, Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he is entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. Now then, how could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. That's called doing a Joseph. One day, which is good advice for you young men who are not yet married. One day, he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. She caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. When she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought in to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. When he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." And she kept his cloak beside her until his master came home. And she told him this story: "That Hebrew slave you brought us came here to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." When his master heard this story, his wife had told him, saying, "This is how your slave treated me." He burned with anger. Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. And so the warden put Joseph in charge of all that was held in the prison, and he made him responsible for all that was done there. See the recurring theme. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did. Amazing, amazing story. And what I want us to do is to just consider some of the lessons that Joseph is beginning to learn in this season of his life in Potiphar's house. Because in many ways, this is the time where Joseph is learning how to live a life beyond himself. He's learning some of the keys, some of the principles to not just living for my own desires, but actually living to make others great. He is learning some important principles. And so let's look at a few of those together. Number one, the first lesson he learns is this, is to serve someone else's vision before he serves his own. It's the first lesson he learns about living beyond himself. If I'm going to live beyond myself, the first principle is, firstly, I need to learn how to serve somebody else's vision before my own. And as I said before, Joseph was living with this prophetic conviction about where his life was heading. One day, I'm going to be a ruler. I'm going to be a leader. People are going to look to me. I'm going to be a responsible man. People are even going to bow down to me. He knew the prophetic track that he was on. And yet, where does he find himself? As a slave in another man's household. So what does he do? He gets to work serving that man first. And he learns this principle that actually, if I'm going to be able to reach my own goal, my own vision, the thing that God has given me to achieve, firstly, I'm going to have to learn how to serve somebody else. I'm going to have to learn how to serve this Egyptian man, Potiphar. And this actually was the root for greatness in Joseph's life, was to serve somebody else. Was to take the path less traveled, which is the path called humility. And it's not that God isn't interested in the desires or dreams or visions or godly ambitions that he's put in each of our lives. It's not that he's not interested in those things. He's very interested because he gave you those things. He gave you those desires to do certain things or to be a certain type of person in the world. He gave you those desires. But actually, the root for those desires being fulfilled is to first learn to serve somebody else's vision. To submit to someone else first. And of course, Jesus again is for us the perfect example of someone who learned that to be great meant laying your life down to serve somebody else's will. And there's a famous occasion where Jesus' disciples were looking for lunch, which was kind of a recurring theme in their life. They were always looking for food. And they're kind of looking for food and they're talking about food. And then Jesus suddenly says something very cryptic to them. He says, I have food to eat that you know nothing about. And they're like, where did he get lunch? And he's like, guys, you don't understand. My food is to do the will of him who sent me. And they're like, oh, we never thought about that. But Jesus is saying, listen, I'm on this planet actually because I'm submitted to somebody else's mission. I'm submitted to the Father's mission. The reason that I'm here, the reason I'm going to actually bleed and die and lay my life down is actually because I am submitted to someone else's vision for my life. I'm learning to serve one. My food is to do the will of him who sent me. So Jesus models to us what it's like to live a life of submission to someone else. One author put it this way. He said that you can only truly find your own commission in the context of submission to a greater apostolic mission. Now, there's lots of issues in that sentence. Okay, you can only find your own commission in life when you actually come under and submit to someone else's apostolic mission. And actually, you begin to find that your own desires and visions begin to come to fruition. They come to the surface because you've decided actually to submit and put yourself under someone else's authority first. I remember doing something called Frontier Project when I was 18, where I really began to kind of learn this principle about serving someone else before my own desires. And I was 18-year-old. I moved to America for a year to Missouri. And I worked in a church for a year, serving under a great friend of mine called Lex Loizides, who's a very passionate Greek evangelist. And Lex is a wonderful, wonderful man, and he's very passionate about preaching the gospel. And I learned that year to really do whatever Lex told me to do. That was why I was there. Okay, he was the boss, and I was there to do whatever he asked me to do. Most of the time, which involved doing things that I really didn't like doing. I don't know if you've ever been in those kind of situations. And, one of Lex's favorite things was to go out into the open air and preach the gospel just to random crowds. So we would pitch up on university campuses or on street corners. He would get his little portable microphone with the batteries in the back. He'd get the microphone out and he'd give it to different ones on the team and we'd have to preach in the open air. And I have to confess, I hated it. I hated doing open airs. I still hate doing open airs. And yet we did an open air almost every week, sometimes two or three times a week, and I didn't like it. And I was learning to submit to someone else's mission. I was learning actually to serve someone else before I could actually be given my own vision to run with. And I remember once a week I was given a class of Chinese students, and my job was to go and teach them English. Again, I hated it. They were lovely people and we had nice tea and chats, but I really didn't like doing it. But Lex asked me to do it, so I had to do it. Another occasion, I remember we were traveling to preach the gospel in a maximum security prison in America. And I have to confess, on the way there, I was literally nearly wetting myself with absolute terror. And these guys were all in there for life. Some of them were on death row. And I just thought, I'm going to die. I'm going to die in this place. I'm going to lose my life the moment I step through that prison door. And I'm just terrified. I, at this stage, haven't even got anything to do yet. I'm just, you know, going to be in the team. But then 5 minutes before we get there, Lex, my team leader, he starts giving us different jobs that we're going to do once we get there. And so in the car, he's giving different jobs to different team members. And he goes to my friend Dan, says, Dan, perhaps you could play a few songs. You know, sing a couple of worship songs, that'd be great. Dan's like, oh, sure, that's fine. He goes to my friend Steve, perhaps you could tell your story of how you became a Christian. Steve's like, yeah, that'd be great. He comes to me, and he's like, Phil, let's think, what could you do? He said, maybe you could just give some personal prophetic words over the inmates. That would be fantastic. I'm like, really? And again, I'm terrified. And I'm praying like I've never prayed before. God, say something, anything. And what I learned during that season was to serve somebody else's vision. Because the truth is, the vision that God has given you for your own life, often the catalyst for that vision being realized is first to submit and serve someone else. Whose mission, whose vision are you serving under? Whose authority are you under? Because actually, it's only once you are under authority you can ever exercise authority. And so Joseph learns this very, very important principle. He learns to serve someone else's vision before his own. Secondly, he learns this principle about learning how to handle favor well. Learning how to handle favor well. It's very interesting that although Joseph had been through this incredible season of pain and rejection at the hands of his own family, and yet we find him acting still in such a princely way when he's in Potiphar's household. You notice the kind of dignity and favor that's on him, even though he's a slave, he's a kept man, and he has no rights anymore, and yet he acts in such a princely way, even in Potiphar's household. So much so that Potiphar recognizes that the favor of God is on this young man. You can have everything in my household, you look after it. God's clearly with you. Isn't that amazing? And the truth is that I believe Joseph understood who he was and that he was a man who was living under the divine unseen favor of God. And that knowledge began to transform the environment around him. And you will find that the nature of your internal world will always begin to transform your outer world. What's in here will start to be reflected out here. Your inner environment will begin to be reflected in your outer environment. And this is exactly what we find happening in Joseph's life. The inner environment of I'm favored by God begins to transform everything around him. And Joseph begins to learn how to handle this unseen divine favor well. And you know, the same is true of us as a community and as individuals. We are those that have favor upon our life. You are favored by God. And we could just start by talking about salvation. Salvation would be enough to talk about for the rest of history and the rest of eternity. The fact that you and I have been given the grace of God, forgiveness from sin, made heirs with Christ, sons and daughters of the living God. That would be enough, wouldn't it? To be favored in that kind of a way would be enough to sing and shout about for eternity long. And yet also there's a sense in which we are favored by the nearness of God's presence to us as a community. And I think sometimes perhaps we don't understand the degree to which we are favored as a community by God. One of the things I get to do is often travel to different places and see different snapshots of what God's doing around the place. And there's some incredible things going on all over the place. But you know what? There is a sense of the favor of God in this church that is very unique. Very unique. It's very, very special. And the truth is that many of us are beginning to see things happen and bubble up in the life of our church community that we have been longing and praying for decades. I mean, decades and decades. And just before Christmas, I could tell you so many stories, but here is a snapshot of some of the evidences, the signs of God's favor among us. In our night shelter, again, in a period of 1 month, they saw 12 residents healed of various diseases or illnesses. Isn't that incredible? In 1 month. Haven't we longed for those kind of days? And yet suddenly this happened. This happened before Christmas. I mean, that's amazing. You know, I was in the corridor again, just I think a week or two before the Christmas break, bumped into a few guys who'd been praying, and they'd just seen three people healed that afternoon. You know, bang, bang, bang. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. The sense of the favor of God upon us. You know, it's just wonderful that we got to send one of our good friends, Zoe Joy, to Zambia. She's now looking after 300 orphans in Zambia. That is flipping phenomenal. I mean, that is incredible. And she's part of our family. I get to influence Zambia through her. It's incredible. You know, one young lady, again, before Christmas, got invited to do some supply teaching in a class. And she was, I think, asked the question to talk about who is Jesus. And in the course of this kind of lesson on who is Jesus, different questions began to get asked. Well, does Jesus still heal today? Does he still do the things that he says he does in the Bible? Because so she was able to tell her story and say, well, yeah, he does. He does the same things. And at the end, when she asked people to respond, I think near enough the whole class responded, put their hand up. I'd like to know this Jesus. And she also prayed for a number who were sick. Again, I think there were over 15 kids who said, yeah, I've experienced healing today in the classroom. Isn't that incredible? And we kind of longed for those kind of days, those kind of moments. You know, different church members increasingly sensing just influence in the nation in different areas, whether it's business or politics or in the family. Again, one church member in our church increasingly is a national voice for the place of fathers and families. Again, regularly on the radio being asked, how does it work? What about family life? Talk to us about family life. What does it look like? And again, being a voice for the kingdom. I tell you, the sense of the favor of God upon us is amazing. It is amazing. These are days that we've longed for, the favor of God. And it doesn't mean that everything is amazing, but I tell you, there's a heck of a lot of things that are amazing. And it's an evidence of the favor of God upon us. And the truth is, how we handle God's favor on us today is critical to where we go to in the future. This is an absolutely critical issue for us as a church. And I would say the heart of the prophetic burden in this message is this, is that we learn how to handle favor well now. Because how we handle what God is doing among us right now is critical to what happens in the future. And what happens in Joseph's life is that he handles the favor that he has then well. And actually the trajectory then is, okay, I'm going to give you favor over nations of the world. How you handle favor now is crucial to what happens in the future. The decisions we make. I was reading the story of a man called Rick Warren. Just wave at me if you've heard of a guy called Rick Warren. He wrote a very well-known book called The Purpose-Driven Life. Okay, many of you may have read this. If you haven't, it's really well worth a read. And you may not realize, but this is the most translated book in English history. In fact, in world history. This book right here. The most translated book in history, right here. So it's worth a read. It's good. And Rick Warren, who is a pastor of a church, there should be a little photo of him up there. He wrote this book really not knowing that it would be this kind of phenomenally best-selling book. And he describes that he became literally a multi-millionaire within the course of a few years after writing this book. He hadn't ever planned that. But this book literally made him millions and millions and millions and millions, like tens of millions of dollars. And he says it scared him half to death, the fact that he had that much money. But I'll read you what it says in an interview with a church in London. He says this. He says, Rick described how 37 years ago, he and his wife Kay started their marriage with a commitment to be more generous with every year that passed in their finances. They started giving away 10% of their income. and then rising it with each year. He says, on the years that we got a raise and things were good, we'd raise our giving 3 to 4%. But on years where we were totally flat broke and the cupboards were bare, we'd try and raise it just a quarter. He said, we didn't do it to show off. In fact, I didn't tell anybody about it for 30 years. But we kept raising it and raising it and raising it. And then this last year, we raised it another percent. Now Kay and I give away 91% of our income. And we live on 9%. Isn't that phenomenal? But then he says this. Here's the key part. It says, people ask why God chose me to write this book. I say, because God knew what I would do with the money. Isn't that phenomenal? God knew what I would do with the money. People say to me that if God gave them tens of millions, then they'd give it away too. No, I say, you wouldn't, because you're not doing it now. I have a 25-year track record of being generous, even in times of my own poverty. Incredibly, incredibly challenging. And he goes on to say, for 37 years, God and I have been playing this game. He says to me, okay, Rick, you give it to me, and I'll give it to you, and we'll see who wins. He said, I've lost that game for 37 years. You cannot outgive God. I dare you to try. Isn't that amazing? I think the thing there is that Rick Warren, he learned long ago how to handle his wealth. And because of that, God was able to entrust to him more. And this is a spiritual principle. Jesus says in Luke 16:10, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. But whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. You see, how we handle the spiritual wealth, the favor that is around us right now, is absolutely critical to whether we plateau and begin to diminish, or whether our ability to live beyond ourselves can increase more. God's design is for us literally to serve the nations of the world. That will be possible if we learn how to handle favor well now. And might I suggest just three things on how we can handle favor well right now. Number one is, let's just keep giving the blessing away. Okay, very simple. If God has blessed you with something, give it away. Give it away. Be generous. Have an attitude of generosity to give what God has given you. And that might be time. It might be gifting. It might be resources. It might be money. It might be compassion. It might be a home that you can show hospitality with. It might be loving people who are on the edge. Whatever it is that God has given you, give it away generously. Bless other people. Once you've received something from him, say, okay, God, how can I give this back out? I dare you to try and outgive God, because you will lose every time. You'll lose every time. And it's the key, actually, to exponential increase. Keep sharing it, giving it away to others. I recently read the biography of Bear Grylls, which is a good book, really worth reading. And it's funny, he talks about his own mother, who's a Christian, and says she just gave stuff away, just the whole of his life. And he'd come home and she'd given his own stuff away. And he'd get irritated with her. But she just lived a life, if someone needed something or wanted something, she'd say, oh, great, there you go, you can have it. I tell you, that kind of attitude is inspiring. Provocative. Another thing that we can do to handle favor well is this, is not to become defensive and stop taking risks. It's interesting, I don't know if you notice this in your own life, the more that you have, the more cautious you can become, because you've got more to lose. And you've got a lot of stuff, got a lot of things going on in your life. It's actually very easy to start living a life that subtly becomes more and more cautious and less risk-taking, because you've got more to lose. It's interesting, if you're a football fan and you watch often kind of football matches, you'll find that a football team, if it goes 1-0 up, they suddenly go into defensive mode and they start kind of backing off and backing off. Why? Because they're playing not to win, they're playing not to lose. And there's a difference between playing to win and playing not to lose anymore. And so often, subtly, in a time of favor, you think, wow, all this amazing stuff's going on. Let's try and keep it. Let's try and bottle it. Let's try and protect it. Let's not take too many risks. Let's kind of hold it all in. But you know what? We didn't get here by being cautious. We got here by believing God. And the same way that we got here is how we're meant to continue. Believe God. Have faith. Take risks. Be a people who are on the front foot saying, God, what are you saying? That's what I want to be involved with. And you know, again, there's a great difference between being a storyteller and a history maker. A storyteller is someone who can only tell stories of things that God did in the past, but actually they're not changing anything in the present. History makers are those who are making history as they walk. And God has called us to be a history-making church. He's called you to be a history-making individual, someone who literally shapes environments around you and brings the glory of God into those situations. That's who you are. A son and daughter of God carries the kingdom wherever they go. You're called to be a history maker, not just a storyteller. Therefore, you need to live a life of increasing risk and faith. And then another thing that we can do to handle favor well in this season is simply to stay humble and to do the things that we did at first. Stay humble and do the things that you did at first. And, you know, again, subtly we can begin to forget why we're in this environment of such favor. The reason we're here is not because we're great, but because God is very kind. God is very gracious. I mean, we didn't particularly get here by lots of our own wisdom or works. We got here because we received the grace of God. So part of the key for us in moving forward and handling favor well now is that we don't forget to do the things that got us here in the first place, which are very simple things like, let's prioritize the presence of God. Let's receive the person of the Holy Spirit. Let's give ourselves to abandoned worship. Let's love the poor. Let's forgive one another deeply from the heart. These are simple things. Let's live a life of prayer. Keep doing the things that got us here in the first place. Stay humble. Stay humble. Third thing Joseph begins to understand about living a life beyond himself is he begins to understand how he's wired. He begins to understand how he's wired. And Joseph had some incredible gifts. Some of them are very obvious. He obviously had a remarkable prophetic gift, this gift of revelation, being able to interpret dreams, understand what was going to happen in the future. But also what we find in Potiphar's house is that Joseph develops some incredible leadership gifts, incredible gift of wisdom, knowing how to administer a household. And there is such leadership favor on his life that he begins to prosper in all that he does. And really, Joseph is learning in this season how to steward the gifts that he has. He understands how he's wired. You know, as a 17-year-old hothead, he didn't really handle his gifts very well. But in this season, there's a subtle change in his life where he begins to understand how to use the motivations and gifts that he has. A remarkable combination in his life. And you know, if we are going to live a life to serve others beyond ourselves, it will be of huge importance to you and I to understand how we're wired, because we're all wired very differently. We're all wired very differently. And I like to call this wiring sometimes our primary motivations. To know that all of us have some primary motivations going on inside of us, some primary instincts and drivers, things that feel to us more important than other things. Do you understand what I mean? We all have a certain primary motivation or wiring going on inside of us. A little bit like that you all speak with an accent, but you can't hear your own accent. Yeah, have you ever noticed that everyone else has an accent, but you don't? It's because you can't hear yourself. And it's the same with primary motivations. All of us have primary motivations, things that are going on in here that we judge events by and decide whether that's important or that's important. We all see the world through an accent, as it were. Again, I don't know if you remember those old 3D glasses that you used to get when you went to the cinema. They're kind of red and blue or red and green. Do you remember those? Yeah, there they are. Red and blue. He's behind you. And you know, you could watch the same picture and close one eye and you would see those pictures through a red filter. You could close the other eye and you would see the same pictures through a blue filter. Same, you're watching the same events, but you're seeing it through a slightly different filter. Well, let me tell you, you all see the world through slightly different filters. You're seeing through a particular lens. And some of that lens that you view the world through is to do with personality, it's to do with circumstance, it's to do with upbringing, it's to do with temperament, it's to do with a whole bunch of things, actually. But also, there are spiritual wirings in your system that cause you to see the world in a certain way. And I call these our primary motivations. And it means that you and I can see the same events and each have a different take on what was important about it. So it means, for example, you can be in this meeting tonight and drive home in your car on the way back. And for some of you, you will think, wow, that bit was really great, but I didn't enjoy that bit. Others of you will think exactly the opposite, because you're seeing the world through a lens. And it's often to do with your particular spiritual gifts or strengths, the things that God's put in you that you have to bring to the table. And the truth is, just like those glasses, if you want to see the proper perspective, you've got to look through all the lenses that God gives. None of us has the whole picture, but together we see a proper perspective. We need one another. And one, I think, great grid for understanding some of our primary motivations when it comes to gifting is Ephesians 4:11. Ephesians 4:11 talks about five gifts that God gives to the church, and they are all very, very different from one another. And this is a helpful framework for you to understand, what is my primary motivation? What's the lens that I view the world through? What is the thing that feels most important to me most of the time? Okay, and I just want to talk through those five things. And as I do, ask yourself, which one best describes me? Okay, as I go through these, ask yourself, which of these best describes me? Ephesians 4:11 simply says this, that it was God who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service so that the body of Christ may be built up. So let me just talk about each of those gifts in turn. Apostolic. What does it look like if you have an apostolic primary motivation? Okay, what does that look like? What does that filter really feel like to you? Well, if you've got a primary apostolic motivation, you are someone who loves to create and transform cultures. You would typically be very, very motivated about the big picture. And, you know, individual life change excites you. But what really excites you is, I want to change a whole environment. I want to make a whole culture work. And typically, if you're apostolic, if that's the lens you're looking through, you love to think about the future. You love the big picture. You love bridging barriers and finding solutions, developing leaders, networking across a whole range of people. And again, as I said, individual life change is important, but it's the big picture that motivates you. Okay? The big picture. What about if you're prophetic? Well, if your lens that you look through is primarily prophetic, you are someone who loves to seek and communicate God's will. The thing that feels most important to you is, did we hear God's voice today? Okay, all the things that have happened in this meeting, if you're prophetic like I am, the thing that I go home thinking about is, did we hear God's voice? You know, everything else was important, but this feels like the most important thing to me. Okay, because I'm wired that way. If you're prophetic, you love to seek and communicate God's will. Prophetic people will often be the ones that kind of challenge the status quo, that kind of unsettle things, because they want to move us on into what God has. Evangelistic gifts. Again, this is the lens you look through. The thing that will feel most important to you most of the time is winning people to Jesus. Are people coming to know Jesus or not? Tonight, did people come to know Jesus or not? That's the most important thing. Shepherding or pastoring gifts. If you're primarily a shepherd or a pastor, the thing that feels most important to you is to nurture and protect community. Do people feel safe? Do they feel secure? Do people know that they belong? Do people feel included? Were the people on the edge brought into the center? Did people feel loved? If you're a shepherd in your primary motivation, those things will be the most important. Or teaching. Teaching gives love to understand and explain truth. They love staying faithful to God's word. God's word is the most important thing. Are we grounded in truth? Do we understand what's true about God? Do we understand what the Bible really says about Jesus? Do we actually understand truth? Do we get truth tonight? Was Phil's message actually biblical? That'll feel like the most important thing to you. And if it wasn't, you'll go home angry. I'm serious. Because we all see the world through these filters. So I wonder, how are you wired? How are you wired? Does one of those areas describe you most of the time? We did a fascinating exercise. We did this exercise in our youth team recently. Sat everyone down in a room. We talked about these kind of five different primary motivations. And the team kind of had to identify where they felt their leaning was most. And it was absolutely fascinating because everybody was very, very different. And suddenly we began to understand why certain issues felt more important to us than others. And why some of us irritated each other. Because that's what happens. Because you see through this lens, and it doesn't look like that lens, so sometimes that lens can irritate you. That person's accent can get on your nerves, because it's not the accent you speak with. And so actually, as a team, we began to talk about these differences. So we had a whole bunch of guys in our team who are real shepherds. The thing that they're most concerned about is, do our young people feel loved? Do they feel secure? Do they know that we think they're amazing? And that they're part of a community? That's the most important thing. Others of us, we had one guy who was a real evangelist. He said, well, most important thing, are people being introduced to Jesus? That's the most important thing to me. And so on and so forth. And it was fascinating because we suddenly began to see a picture of how God has wired us. And I tell you, if you want to live a life beyond yourself, it will help you massively if you understand yourself a little bit more and those around you. The truth is, none of us has the whole picture. God put you in a church because you need other people and because they need you. Isn't that amazing? Love being the church. Church is amazing. Number four, we're coming in for a landing. Number four, his something else that Joseph learned in Potiphar's house was this. He learned not to get distracted. He learned not to get distracted, and the distraction for Joseph came in the form of Potiphar's wife, who was very randy and wanted to go to bed with him constantly, it would seem. And despite the attentions of Potiphar's wife, Joseph every day says, no, my master has given me instructions. How could I sleep with you? You're his wife. And he does a Joseph and he legs it as far as he can. Which again, young men, that's really good advice. He does a Joseph. And the truth is that when a man like Joseph begins to experience the favor of God and almost everything he touches seems to be blessed, the enemy will come and try and distract a man like that in any way that he possibly can. And in a church where the favor of God is resting on us, we need to understand that the enemy, he notices, he knows what's going on, and he wants to distract us from keeping the main thing the main thing. And he will try all different ways to try and distract us. Often in church communities, it can be just things like kind of grumbling and complaining and irritation with one another and unforgiveness and forming cliques and those kind of things can start to kind of get into the system, and it begins to distract us from keeping the main thing the main thing. And it's not that it's not important not to work out our issues. Of course it is. But somehow subtly the enemy can just come and take our head off center. And cause us to focus on issues that actually, they're important, but they're not the main thing. And for Joseph, he learned in a season of favor how not to get distracted, but instead to stick hard and fast on doing what his master had asked him to do. And so the most important question for us is this. What has Jesus asked us to do, and are we doing it? What are your master's instructions? What are you doing about those instructions? That is the most important question. Everything else is like white noise. What has Jesus asked you and I to do? Individually, but also together. What has he asked us to do? Want to handle favor well, we must learn to say no to distractions. And then lastly, Joseph discovers this truth that trials are often a doorway to your destiny. Trials are often a doorway to your destiny. It's interesting for Joseph that although he acted with incredible integrity, yet he suffered for it still. He didn't get a good result. He got thrown into prison. You ever done the right thing and got the wrong result? You ever tried that? You think, well, I've lived a really godly life. I've really obeyed Jesus. I've said yes to what he asked me to do. Why am I in this stinking prison then? You ever been in those moments? I have. And sometimes in those moments, we can be fooled into thinking, well, God's favor has left me then. Where's God? He was with me 5 seconds ago. Now I'm in a prison. Prison of circumstance or heartache or confusion or difficulty or pain. Where is God? Why has his favor left me? Well, the truth is for Joseph is that the favor of God didn't leave him. The favor of God went with him into the prison and he began to transform that prison into a place of incredible abundance. And he learned actually, even in trial, sometimes God uses trials in our life as a doorway into the increased favor that he wants to pour out in our life. So often tests are the doorway to your destiny. For Joseph, he never would have got to the palace if he didn't first go through the prison. That is exactly true. He never would have got to the palace. If you read the story, you'll find being in prison was crucial to him eventually meeting Pharaoh and doing what God had given him to do. He never would have got there had he not gone through the doorway of trials and tests in his life. I love the analogy that Bill Johnson uses of a gardener who prunes a tree so that it becomes more fruitful. And in scripture, it describes Jesus as a wonderful gardener who comes to tend the branches of your life. And that he prunes you and I sometimes to make us more fruitful. What Bill Johnson says about that, he says, Jesus is committed to pruning you so that you can survive the weight of his blessing. I love that. That suddenly makes pruning take on a slightly different perspective, doesn't it? Yes, I'm going through a test. Yes, I'm going through a trial. Yes, this is difficult right now. But Jesus is at work in me. His favor is still upon me. And he is pruning me right now so that I can survive the weight of his blessings. Because my trajectory is the palace. That's where I'm headed. I know what God's asked me to do. I know that's where I'm heading. So right now, his favor is at work in me to get me ready for that day. Trials are often the doorway to your destiny. And I remember, I'll finish with this story. When I was taking a sabbatical from work in 2009, I took some time out of work just to pray, to seek God. And it was an incredible time of God really renewing me, setting me free, and doing a whole bunch of kind of inner work in my life. And I came out of that sabbatical feeling unshackled from the fear of man and ready to rumble. And I felt confident and I felt bold and I was strutting my stuff. And I was thinking, I know where things are heading. The favor of God is on me right now. And I kind of walked back into work and back into my circumstances and then had probably the most testing 2.5 years that I've had in my life following that. Where suddenly I had an opportunity to put all that favor to good use. Because the truth is, God will always set you up for success. And often you'll find that the thing that God's just done in your life is preparation for the circumstances you're about to walk into. The very lesson you just learned about God in that last season actually was given to you so that you could put it to effect in the season that you're now in. His favor gives you what you need to win so that even in a prison, you can turn it into a place of abundance where the kingdom is expressed and extended and you can live a life beyond yourself. And these are some of the things that Joseph learned.